chapter 4. So last week we weren't here. It was too cold. So the week before last week, we were looking through chapter 3 and we saw that David was making an alliance with Abner, the son of Ner, who was basically in charge of the northern kingdom under Ishbosheth. Ishbosheth is a king in name only. He's a puppet ruler. And Abner was aggravated with him because of an accusation that Ishbosheth made against Abner. And so Abner was trying to form an alliance with David, and he had secured the pledge of all of the northern tribes that they would swear their allegiance to David and join the two kingdoms. So Abner came to David at Hebron. They made the deal. Abner was on his way home, and then Joab found out about it. Took matters into his own hands, murdered Abner, and David then called both Joab and the nation to a time of mourning to show that it was not David's intention to put Abner to death. A very important part of the political goings-on there, but also important for David to make this public declaration that he had not okayed the murder of Abner because it was against God's law. Abner was murdered. He wasn't taken out in a lawful way. He wasn't killed in a battle. He was murdered by Joab. However, David doesn't have enough evidence to convict Joab because the thing was done in private and there were no witnesses. And according to God's law, there had to be at least two witnesses to the event to be able to convict of murder and therefore put to death. So David, being a righteous man, refuses to act contrary to God's law. And we saw what a great example that was of being a godly ruler on David's part. And so he does what he can, which is show to the entire nation that he was not the one who had instigated the murder of Abner. And so we come to chapter 4, and this continues the narrative after the news of Abner's death gets spread around. Chapter 4, verse 1, when Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. This is not surprising, considering the weight that Abner's voice held in the northern kingdom. Remember, it was Abner that set up Ishbosheth as the king over the northern tribes. It was Abner that was waging the wars against David. It was Abner that reconquered Jezreel and all of the territory that the Philistines captured when Saul was killed. Abner has been the one holding that northern kingdom together. And so news of his death was terrifying to the kingdom, especially since what Abner had just done, which was secured a statement from all of the northern tribes, including Benjamin, that they were going to join David. But now the guy leading that movement is dead. And Ishbosheth is still alive, so you can understand. Ishbosheth is terrified because the only man holding him up as king is gone. And he probably knows the rumors that are going around that the nation doesn't want him to be king anymore and that they are ready to go side with David. So you can understand why Ishbosheth and his courage failed. And you can understand why all of Israel is greatly dismayed, because now without Abner, what's going to happen to this movement to join David? Or should they still go forward with that? Or is Ishbosheth going to take control? Or is somebody else going to take control? This throws the entire nation into a sense of turmoil as to what's going to happen next. Imagine what would happen in America if all of our leaders suddenly were taken off the scene. All of the men who had any say, anyhow. I mean, we have a pretty strong line of succession from the president to the vice president to the speaker of the house. And where does it go on from there? I'm not sure. But we work to protect that line pretty carefully so that all of those leaders are almost never in one place at one time to make sure that if something happens, some catastrophic event happens, we don't lose our entire chain of command and we have somebody to succeed it. Ishbosheth doesn't have that now. Abner's gone and the nation is thrown into turmoil because of Abner's death. So that is the statement that's going to overhang everything that's going on in this chapter. Verse 2, now Saul's son had two men. Now Saul's son is Ishbosheth. had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Ramon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth. For Beeroth is counted part of Benjamin. So here's this little bit of background information about these two guys, and he tells us that these men are from Beeroth, and about the only thing we need the projector for this evening is to take a look at this. Beeroth is right here, just south of Gibeon. Saul's palace was here at Gibeon. We won't say palace. Don't think like Buckingham Palace, because back in these days, the kingdoms were much smaller, and so his palace was probably a wooden or stone house, not real, real huge, but just enough for him to live in. It wasn't until David and Solomon that Israel really started building huge palaces for themselves. Gibeah. Saul had the head of his government here at Gibeah. But when Saul died and Ishbosheth set up his seat of government over here in Mahanaim, you say, what happened to all of this area in Gibeon? Well, we're not really sure. We get a little bit of background information here with these two characters, Baanah and Rechab, the sons of Rimmon. They are from Benjamin. That is pointed out for us because who else is from Benjamin? King Saul is, and he's dead. Abner was. He was Saul's uncle. Abner's from Benjamin. Who else is a Benjaminite in this narrative? Ishbosheth is a Benjaminite. This is going to be an important detail for how these two men play out in this storyline. Because Ishbosheth and these two men are both from the same tribe. Probably that's why Ishbosheth has appointed them to the positions that he has. It says they're captains of raiding bands, which means they weren't part of the regular army. They would take small groups of very mobile soldiers, and they would go off and they would raid. Rather than engaging in open battles, they would just break in and steal supplies or harass the enemy somehow. And so it wasn't open warfare that these two men were engaged in. You always have to be careful, don't you, when you start engaging in subterfuge as a nation, because how is that going to play back upon you when these people are accustomed to doing things this way? So these guys are engaged in subterfuge quite a bit. They're captains of these raiding bands. They are from Benjamin. Now he says they are from Beeroth, and then he gives us this explanation that Beeroth is accounted part of Benjamin. Now the reason he says that is if you look at the map and see where Beeroth is located, south of Gibeah and southwest of Gibeah, you're getting very close to Judah's territory. And so it's possible that Beeroth was so close to the border that somebody reading this might confuse it for being a Judean town and then wonder why these two men were counted as being Benjaminites if they're from a Judean town. But he goes out of his way to let us know that Beeroth is a Benjaminite town, and to establish that these two fellows are indeed from the tribe of Benjamin. The Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourners there to this day. This is a statement that confuses us a little bit because he doesn't give us any other information than that. We're not sure why they fled. We're not sure when they fled. We're not even sure where Gittaim is, except to say that these Beerothites fled that city and went to a different one and have been there for quite a while, because if you go back in your minds, because I know you all remember every detail of the introductory sermon we did on these two books, right? And we said that 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, and 2 Kings, probably all written by the same person. And 2 Kings takes us all the way into the captivity to Babylon, several years into it, in fact. So if the writer says they have fled there to this day, then that gives us a statement that the Benjaminites have been living in Gittaim for hundreds of years. And it's because for some reason they got kicked out of Beeroth. We're not sure why, but they did. Could be that at one point the Philistines came in and invaded and everybody from Beeroth fled. But all of that background information is given to show us that these two men, Baanah and Rechab, are Benjaminites, and establishing them as members of Ishbosheth's own tribe. So, you might suspect that these two Benjaminites related to the king would be in support of him and want to maintain power within their own tribe. After all, Saul was from Benjamin. And so they were probably pretty happy to have the kingship residing with the tribe of Benjamin. But more on that here in just a little bit. We have another background or explanatory note in verse 4. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. Now, this is the first that we have heard about this within these historical books. Jonathan was David's good friend throughout his life, but he died at the side of his father Saul in the Battle of Jezreel on Mount Gilboa. And we're told here, finally, that Jonathan left a son. Now, why might that be pertinent information? Yeah, he would be in line for the throne then, wouldn't he? Because Jonathan was Saul's oldest son, so the kingship should have passed from Saul to Jonathan, and from Jonathan to his son, if you're going in a normal succession of a monarchy from father to the oldest son. However, Ishbosheth has been reigning now. For anybody remember, how long has Ishbosheth been reigning in Mahanaim?
4 years.
A little longer.
5 years.
Keep going. Do I have six? It's been 7 years. David set himself up, or didn't set himself up, was set up as king in Hebron, and he reigned in Hebron for 7.5 years. And that's when all of Israel comes to make him king over all of Israel, and he moves his capital to Jerusalem. So Israel is going to make David king in the next chapter, chapter 5. They make him king because Ishbosheth has recently been killed, so we're sort of jumping ahead and then working our way backwards to find out this timeline. So we start with David becoming king in Hebron. We know he's there for 7.5 years. And we know that he became king over all Israel because Ishbosheth died. So that gives us this 7.5 years. We're right before that. We're at about 7 years when we're talking about these men. How old was Jonathan's son when Jonathan died? He was 5. A little 5-year-old when his daddy dies in the battle. So Jonathan had this son fairly late in life, because when Jonathan died, he was probably somewhere in his 60s. We're not entirely sure on that. We're not given specifics about his age, but we can guess. He was a commander of an army when Saul became king, and so he had to be at least in his early to mid-20s. And Saul reigned for almost 40 years. And so when Jonathan died, he's in his 60s somewhere. So he had this son late in life, Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth was 5 years old when Saul died. Saul dies the same time David becomes king. So when David becomes king, Mephibosheth is 5. We are 7 years later. So Mephibosheth is how old now? 12 years old. Good. 12, almost 13. And what does that say about Mephibosheth and his ability to take succession of the throne? He's too young, right? Even if he is in succession, that's young to take the throne. Any of us want to elect a 12-year-old president? Might pull. So this section seems like it doesn't fit, because you're jumping from talking about these two men of Benjamin and how they relate to Ishbosheth, and oh, by the way, Jonathan had a son, Mephibosheth, and he was 5 years old when his dad died, and his nurse took him up and fled, and as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. Casual reading might say, this doesn't fit here. What is this talking about? But the point he's trying to make is, he's setting up the stage for the fact that Ishbosheth is going to be... We can kind of get that feeling just from what's going on and how the people have felt about Ishbosheth anyway. So he's not given a, what do they call that, when you give out the plot of a movie ahead of time? Spoiler alert. He's kind of given a little bit of a spoiler alert here. So, oh, by the way, talking about Ishbosheth being king, Jonathan had a son. Wait a second. Jonathan's son should be king. Yeah, he should be, but he's only 12 years old. He was only 5 when his dad died, too young to take the throne. And so Abner made Ishbosheth king instead. And even at this point, if Ishbosheth dies, or the people kick him off the throne, he's still too young to take the throne. Now, we have a couple instances in Israelite history that we'll get to at some point of very young kings. Josiah, 8 years old, takes the throne. But even in that instance, he's not the one calling the shots for quite a while. He has some governors and some helpers that are making the decisions for him until he comes of age. Because even though he's crowned king, he's not king in an official sense. And so Mephibosheth, too young. But also, what else is wrong with Mephibosheth? He's lame. He can't lead the armies in and out. He can't take care of the tasks of being a king. Being a king was not only administrative, as it is these days. He would have had to have been able to take the armies in and out in battle and lead them in combat. He can't do that. So this little section is to show us that even though there is a successor to the throne, if Ishbosheth dies or is removed from the throne, he's not suitable to take the throne. So this is the end of a dynasty, as the title of our message is. This is the end for Saul's dynasty. So this little comment about Mephibosheth fits in there with what the writer is trying to tell us, that Saul's dynasty is coming to an end. So, verse 5, going back to the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, they set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. Now, about what time is the heat of the day? Understanding they didn't have clocks back then, so they didn't measure it in hours the way we do. Yeah, right around 2 o'clock or so, when it really starts to get hot. And we get this note that they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. Mediterranean nations still do this quite a bit, and then in the middle of the day, they take a siesta. You tell all your guys to take a nap in the middle of the day, right about 2 o'clock? Yep. Say, lay down, guys, take a couple hours, just have a nap, relax, you know. But that's what they do. It gets so hot over there that in the middle of the day, there's not much that you can be doing. And so they take a siesta. And for a couple of hours, they relax. Now, if you think that that means they're lazy, then just remember these guys were probably up at 5 o'clock and have been running all day until noon. So they've put in just about a full work day already. They're going to take a couple hours off here to rest, and then they're going to go back at it for another 6 or 7 hours. So they work pretty good. But in the middle of the day, when it's really, really hot, they take a break. And so here these two men come into the palace while Ishbosheth is on his siesta, his noonday rest, and they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat. Now, what does that "as if" mean? So they're sneaky. They're not actually there for a loaf of bread, right? So not too often. It was often, actually, that you would go in there. Because, again, the palace, we're not thinking Buckingham Palace, very ornate decorations designed to intimidate foreign dignitaries visiting and things. You're talking about the center of the government. So that would be where the storehouse was. That would be where the armory was kept. Remember, David had a room built called the House of the Forest of Lebanon. And it had shields and it had spears in it. Those weren't for decoration. Those were actually armament. If you go to Colonial Williamsburg, anybody been to Colonial Williamsburg? Yeah. Did you go to the governor's mansion? And they've got just weapons hanging all over. It's like my dream house. It's great. Guns hanging on the wall, swords and spears everywhere. Well, that wasn't just for decoration. That was the armory. And they would hang all these things on the wall, not only to impress visiting dignitaries, but also if there was a need, the soldiers could come in and arm themselves very quickly. So the royal palace would have been something like this. It would have been a storehouse. It would have been a barracks. It would have been the place where the king had his room. And so them coming in to get wheat is not an unusual thing. They are acting as if they have returned from a raid and they are provisioning their troops. So they come into the palace to resupply. Only, they're not actually there to resupply, because as if to get wheat. And what do? They stab him in the stomach. What's that? And then they behead him, just to make sure the deed is done, right? Stabbing in the stomach you might recover from. Probably not with the medical technology in those days, but it's possible. Beheading? I don't know, Dan. We probably still can't fix that, can we? What's that? Elmer's will do it? What's that? Takes more than a Band-Aid. Okay, yeah. I think I saw an article the other day. I didn't read it, but the headline was something about a head transplant they wanted to try. I said, whew. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. What's that? Have they? Yeah. We can transplant a lot of things. It's kind of impressive, but... Yeah. Yeah, you start playing around with the brain and the spinal system, and you're dealing with things we don't understand fully. So, well, yeah, they stab him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. So this is... That verse is somewhat a summary, because we're going to get into more of the detail of it here in verse 7. So in verse 6, he just tells us they came in, they stabbed him, they ran. But that's not all, so this isn't a contradiction. It's a literary device that the scriptures often use to state the whole story in summary form and then expand on it in the next passage. So Genesis chapter 1, a lot of people have made a big deal out of why Genesis, the end of Genesis 1 with the creation of man, and Genesis 2, they act like they're two different accounts of creation. That crazy Bible, can't trust a thing in it, can you? Can't even get its creation stories right. But it's a literary device. It piques your interest. It says, well, hey, take a look at this. I'm going to tantalize you with this little preview of what's happening, and then we're going to unfold it completely. So we get this statement, the Rechab and Baana, his brother, escape. So we know they're getting out of the palace without getting caught in this act. They stab him in the stomach to kill him. Verse 7, when they came into the house, as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, why are they going to include this detail here? What does laying on his bed in his bedroom have anything to do with the price of tea in China? What's that? He's defenseless. The man's asleep. Isn't this a brave show of cowardice, really, isn't it? That these two guys are coming in and to assassinate the king, they're going to do it while he's sleeping. Don't even give him a sporting chance to pick up a sword and defend himself. So it is really painting these two characters as cowards. But that shouldn't be surprising, given the nature of the job that they were given by Ishbosheth, with the raiding bands to go in, to plunder the helpless farmers, take all their stuff, and come back, without having to actually engage the armies. So, he's laying on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him. And that's referring back to stabbing him in the stomach. They put him to death and beheaded him. That's not two different statements, by the way. This is all, they put him to death. Beheading him is sort of an elaboration on it, right? So, they put him to death. They cut off his head. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night. Now, let me give you a little show here of the Arabah. And I'm going to zoom out on our map just a bit so you can see it. Mahanaim is here on the highlands on the east side of the Jordan River, which runs down here. If you can see this dark swath, it's because they're trying to portray the shadowy nature of this land, because it is a massive depression that the Jordan River has worn down over millions and millions of years, right? And its flow southward from the Sea of Galilee, probably just a few days after the flood, this channel had been cut in the rock. But it is a deep valley. You go from... up here around Mahanaim, you are at something like 700, 800, 900 feet. I know, that's a real accurate number right there, right? So you're up there at right about 700 feet. And down here in the Jordan River Valley, you are at 1,200 feet below sea level. So you have an almost 2,000 feet change of elevation. This is a very deep valley, and this is the Arabah. So if you see that mention of the Arabah in Scripture, a lot of times it's talking about this, the Jordan River Valley. So they descend into the Arabah, probably via this river here. I think that's the Jabbok River that flows down through this ravine into the Jordan. And then they came south along the Jordan River, and then they went to Hebron, way down here on the southern end of our map. It's quite a long trek, which tells us why it took them all night to make it. So they went by the way of the Arabah all night, and they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. I don't think that Amazon is delivering these with drones yet, but it might not be too long. Who knows? So rather than having the little drone hover down in front of David's door, these two men knock on his door, and they say, "Hey, we've got a present." They bring his head to him at Hebron. And they said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul." Now, Gary, you've got a KJV. Can you read that verse for me, starting with where they begin talking?
Verse 8.
Yes.
"And he brought the head of Ishbosheth and to David to Hebron, and said to the king, 'Behold the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, thine enemy, which sought thy life, and the Lord avenged my lord the king, this head of Saul, and of his seed.'"
Okay, so the first word that they begin speaking is "behold." Remember what we said "behold" means? Here's something to take notice of. Now, it might seem redundant. Somebody holds up a lopped-off head by the hair and says, "Behold," because I can guarantee that somebody does that and you're already taking notice, because this is unusual. This is something out of the ordinary. Not every day do you get a head presented to you by two guys that you don't know who they are. But it would have been evident to David right off the bat who this was. I'm sure he knew Ishbosheth by sight. Remember, David spent lots of time at the royal palace with Saul before he was driven out, so he knew Ishbosheth. He knew him personally. "And so these men, they said to the king, 'Behold, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life.'" What are they trying to build up here? A reason. Hey, he was trying to kill you, wasn't he? He was trying. Now, at what time did Ishbosheth try to kill David? None that's recorded. Oh, he fought against David in the wars. Ishbosheth's men fought against David's men, but that's a far cry from an attempt on your life. So they're making this up to try and bolster their position and their reason for having done what they did. They're trying to justify their killing of him. And look at what else they try to do. "The Lord has avenged my lord the king this day on Saul and on his offspring." Who did this? Those two guys did. Why do you think they're going to claim the name of Jehovah on this? Makes it sound better, doesn't it? I mean, if I can say, "Oh, look what God has done. God didn't do this. You did this." Would God advocate the murder of somebody? No, of course not. And David's going to respond to that the way God tells him to here, but they are trying to bolster their position. They're trying to justify what they have done, and they're trying to say that their actions were in line with what God has said. This is going to be an example to us of how important it is that we are constantly aligning our thinking with what God tells us, so that we make sure we don't allow this kind of stinking thinking to creep into our minds. Do you know how quickly we succumb to this sort of reasoning? You know how quickly we stoop down to saying things like, "Well, God wants me to do this. God wants me to do this." Well, how do you know God wants you to do that? Did he tell you that? Does he say it in his word? We have to be careful about what we allow into our thinking as far as the actions that we're going to be taking. These guys have completely allowed this unbiblical reasoning to enter their thinking, that just because Ishbosheth had not aligned his kingdom with David, therefore they were justified in killing him. Or just because God had promised David the kingdom, that meant they were okay to kill him. When did God say that he was going to avenge David on Saul, or on Jonathan, or on Ishbosheth? He never did. He told David, you're going to be king. He did tell Saul that you're done, your dynasty's not going to continue, but never once did God tell David, I'm going to avenge you for what Saul's done for you. He said, I'm going to protect you. He's going to stand up for David. But they're taking an unbiblical line of reasoning here, and David is going to pick up on that. Verse 9, David answered Rechab and Baana his brother, the sons of Rimmon the Beerothite, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity. I love this statement. Because despite the fact that they're trying to justify the murder of Ishbosheth, David's going to fall back on his faith and say, you know what? I didn't need you to take care of this for me. Because who has taken care of me throughout all of these years of wandering? David had wandered from Saul, hiding in the caverns and in the wilderness for 5-6 years. And who protected him every step of the way? God did. Did David ever need anybody to take things into their own hands and do it themselves? Not once. So he's going to start rebuilding righteousness in his thinking and in their thinking by contradicting what they've said. I didn't need you guys to do this for me. As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, God would have taken care of this. God would have done it the right way. He didn't need you two to step in. And every time we think we've got to take matters into our own hands and force God's will upon a situation, we're going to mess it up. Let God take care of it. As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. So you have to go back to what happened at Ziklag. Saul was dead on Mount Gilboa, and the Amalekite saw it happen, came down to David, and reported it as if he had done it. And David seized him and killed him. Because by his own confession, he had killed the king. And so David is drawing from that and saying, you guys think you're going to get good news. You brought me the head of Ishbosheth, hoping that I was going to reward you. Because deliverers of news did get paid for it. If you ran to give a message, remember they didn't have Instagram, they didn't have Twitter, they didn't have email or Facebook, so you couldn't just sit down and say, David says, well, Baana has to sit down and say, well, I got to update my status here, going in to kill Ishbosheth. Be back in a few. Okay. And let everybody know I'm going to take care of this. Send a picture of Ishbosheth's head to David onto his Twitter account. So you can imagine David standing at the royal palace and his phone starts buzzing and he pulls it out. And, oh, look at that. In order to get news spread quickly, you sent a runner. Or you sent somebody on a horseback. A lot of times they would just run, though. We got an example of that coming up in chapter 18 when Absalom is killed. Joab sends the news by a runner. And he sends one runner to deliver the message of Absalom's death and his defeat, and thus David's victory. And another man wants to run and tell the news himself, but Joab says, why? You'll have no reward for it. What's he saying? You're not going to get paid for this. You're not going to get paid for delivering this news because messengers got paid for it. And if it was good news, you got really paid. It's like getting the tip as a paper boy. If you did a really good job and the headlines were all good that week, you might get a better tip than if you're delivering bad news all week. So they're hoping for good news, and David's letting them in on a little secret. Say, look, you think you're delivering good news, but here's the reward I'm going to give you. You remember the guy back at Ziklag? What reward did he get for delivering that news? He got executed. So guess what? If I did that to him, verse 11, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous man in his own house, on his bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? A righteous man? What's he saying here about Ishbosheth? He didn't deserve to die. God's law gave strict rules for what qualified somebody to be put to death. And Ishbosheth had not committed any of them. And David recognizes that. David is the king of Judah. He is the one who is to administer God's judgment and justice according to the standards of Moses' law that God gave to Israel. And that's exactly what he's doing. Ishbosheth did not deserve to die under any of the standards of the Mosaic covenant. And so David terms him a righteous man. He didn't deserve to die. However, what does he call these two guys? You're wicked. Why? Because you killed a man on his own bed. You invaded his house. Guess what the Mosaic law gives permission for when someone invades your house? You are allowed to defend your home with lethal force, according to the Mosaic covenant. That's one of the reasons that so many of our states have castle doctrine. If you're in your house and someone breaks in, you are legally justified to use lethal force in defending your home. It's a biblical principle. And so David recognizes that, and he's drawing this from, this is Numbers chapter 35, verses 30 to 34. We looked at this a couple of weeks ago when he talks about, how shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? In Numbers 35, God says the only way to atone for a murder is with the blood of the murderer. There is no sacrifice that atones for murder under the Mosaic covenant. So as the king, as the representative of all the people, the only way God, or the only way David can restore Israel to a place of blessing is to execute the murderer. Otherwise, the land is stained with blood. Now, let me ask you a question. A couple of weeks ago, we saw Joab murdered Abner, but David did not execute him. Why not? Why does he not execute Joab, but he's going to execute these two? Exactly. There were no witnesses to Joab's murder. Where did Joab commit the act? One of the rooms inside the gate. So who saw him do it? Well, Joab saw it, and his brother saw it. But do you think they confessed it? No. So you don't have any witnesses. These two guys make a mistake. Because they come up to David's door, hold up the head, and they probably tell him, look what we've done. He's got the confession right out of their own mouth. That's all the evidence he needs. Testimony of two or more witnesses. These guys have condemned themselves to death because they confessed the crime. Whereas Joab didn't. There wasn't enough evidence to convict Joab, even though everybody kind of knew he did it. But you see, David upholding God's standards in refusing to break the law in order to punish someone he knew was guilty, even though he couldn't prove it. You understand? What a mockery of justice it would be for him to put Joab to death when there were no witnesses. Because if David is willing to break God's law in that case, will he be willing to break God's law again? Yeah. So David is again showing himself to be a man of great character because he's going to uphold God's word, even if it's inconvenient for him. Wouldn't it probably have been more politically expedient for him to execute Joab? Would have saved him a lot of trouble down the line, too. Because Joab is not going to be a help. Well, he is kind of going to be somewhat of a help, but he's going to be a thorn in David's side throughout the rest of his career. But David's a man. Read through the Psalms, and how often does he talk about the law of God being his delight and the thing that he meditates on day and night? We read it this morning in Psalm chapter 1. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is on the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. How can David write such a thing? Because he did it. Because he meditated on God's word constantly. That's why he knew how to apply it in these different situations. So that he knew, as a king, I cannot execute Joab because I don't have witnesses.